Hello, my name is Jonathan Freibert, and I am Director for External Affairs here at Microsoft, and I also manage the Voices for Innovation community. Thank you, everyone, for joining our webinar today on what I think will be a very interesting and timely discussion. So I know a number of you are new to the Voices for Innovation community, so welcome. Thank you for joining us today. I did want to take a minute to introduce you to the Voices for Innovation community, tell you a little bit about what we do, and then I'll introduce our speakers for today. So, Voices for Innovation is made up of a community of technology and business leaders, and we're supported by and sponsored by Microsoft. And our purpose is to educate and engage our community on public policy issues that impact your companies, that impact your customers. And we do this in a number of ways. We host webinars and forums to bring business leaders like yourself together to learn about some of these key issues that's impacting the sector. We also, through our website, we have a platform that enables you to communicate with your elected officials about some of the issues that we talk about or other issues that you think are important. And in addition to that, we also host Microsoft business executives who share with the community some of the technology, not only the technology challenges, but some of the things that they're working on. So recently, for example, we had Margot Day, who's Microsoft's Vice President of Education, talk about Vice President of U.S. Education, talk about some of the areas and places she's focused on with that business. We also enable active participants to work with us at Microsoft, as well as some of the other active members in the community, on policy areas that's affecting your businesses and your customers. So we try to facilitate opportunities, to work not only with Microsoft, but also with other Microsoft partners and other business leaders who are part of the community. So we've been around for roughly about 10 years, and we look forward to those who are joining us for the first time to having you get involved with Voices for Innovation. So with that, I'm going to introduce two people. First, I'm going to introduce Mike McMahon, who also works on Voices for Innovation. He's a Senior Director of External Affairs here at Microsoft. He's based in Washington, D.C. And then with me in my office in Redmond, Washington, is Gene Burris, who's Assistant General Counsel, who's going to be talking about the Microsoft warrant case and what's happening in that. So with that, Mike, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. Hello, everyone from the other Washington. I think I know many of you on the call, but pleased to meet the others who I don't know virtually. I just want to talk about an issue that that is before Congress right now and sort of do a very, a very broad sort of level set. And then Gene Burris will talk more specifically about a case that's driving lots of this debate in Washington, D.C. right now and in capitals around the world. I'll start by saying that we have a problem that needs to be solved. The U.S. government is taking steps that undermine trust in American technology firms. Our government is currently seeking to apply search warrants on an extraterritorial and even worldwide basis. So that means like reaching into data centers around the world that are run by U.S. technology companies. Think Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Cisco, others, even in cases involving matters such as narcotics cases and involving suspects who are not U.S. citizens and are not U.S. residents. This is undermining confidence around the world in U.S. technology. We see that in the form of a variety of laws that are being debated and some being passed in countries that makes it harder for providers in Europe to hire U.S. firms to store their data on the cloud of U.S. firms. This threatens to reduce economic opportunities abroad and jobs here at home for the American tech sector, which is one of the crown jewels of the American economy, as you all know. The situation is growing worse as competing laws are increasingly putting global tech firms like Microsoft in a position of dealing with laws that conflict with each other, because there's not a lot of uniformity between these laws necessarily. Global companies must obey the laws and respect the rights of consumers and companies in the countries where we do business. That's true for companies who do business here in the U.S., and that's true for U.S. firms that do business overseas. Increasingly, the passage of new legal rules is creating a situation in which compliance with U.S. extraterritorial search warrants will cause violations of those laws in those countries where we operate. So this extraterritorial warrants are part of a constellation of issues that has caused international tension, as illustrated by the recent Safe Harbor issue, which, for those of you who may not know, the Safe Harbor issue was an agreement, European law, data protection laws, data privacy laws, in some instances are more strict than they are here in the U.S., but obviously the nature of global technology is that it's global. People want to communicate with people around the world. There are lots of multinational companies who have employees in other parts of the world. People may travel to Europe for sales business and want to use their company's technology in Europe and send data back to the U.S. So that's just the nature of technology as it exists today. The Safe Harbor Agreement was an agreement between European regulators, the European governments, and U.S. that would basically sort of allow for this disparity in privacy protection laws between, with data flowing between the two continents, and it was a way to sort of smooth out some of the specific areas where the laws didn't match up specifically. A user of Facebook in Europe, a European citizen, sued in the European courts, claiming that there was no guarantee that his data was being protected. The European court agreed and threw out the Safe Harbor Agreement. So there was a lot of press back in October about this. What did it mean? Did it mean a lot of U.S. providers are in violation of European data protection laws? On top of that, I saw a Bloomberg News article where European regulators were meeting to decide to level new fines against firms that were in violation of European data protection laws. And what they agreed to do, which will not be implemented until 2017, but they agreed to allow for fines up to 15% of the global revenues of a firm that is found to be in violation of data protection laws in Europe. Not only would that firm that made that technology, so imagine like an app provider or a mobile app game provider that had data that was flowing back and forth because they charged credit card information, not only would that firm that made the app be held liable potentially, so could the cloud service provider on the back end that where the data was being stored. So someone who wasn't even processing the data necessarily, but was just storing it could be held in violation, and that they could be charged up to 15% of their global revenues. So this situation in fact results from an even broader problem, which is current laws are outdated. The principal domestic laws on which government relies, the U.S. government relies, which is driving all this sort of confusion and problematic scenarios, is a law called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA, which is now 30 years old. Simply put, it no longer reflects the way technology works. ECPA governs when people's data must be kept private and when and how law enforcement gets access to it. It was written in 1986 when the first laptop was introduced. When car phones were just catching on, the World Wide Web, to give you a sense of how outdated this law is, the World Wide Web was still 3 years away from being invented. So when Congress drew up the ECPA laws, there was no way they could have considered the global reach that the cloud would become and how people would use it and how they would use it in their work and their play and how they communicate with it every single day 30 years later. So the government's reliance on this outdated law has serious implications for the privacy rights of businesses and for customers in the U.S. as well as abroad. Cloud computing is the future of technology. As we all know, I don't need to tell this audience that. You all know that. You live it every day. Americans recognize this and don't believe that something they write and store in the cloud should be any less private than something they write in a letter that's on paper. Yet the government's application of this ECPA law, which is 30 years old, is creating a situation in which personal information, no matter how personal or sensitive, once it's stored in the cloud, takes on a different character than information stored on paper in a desk drawer or on a hard drive domestically here in the U.S. So, and Gene will talk a little bit more about that issue, specifically what the court, what the U.S. government is arguing in our court case. But finally, I'll end by saying Congress needs to address these problems and modernize the laws by passing the LEADS Act and pursuing agreements with other governments. And just in short, I'll tell you that the LEADS Act takes a modernized approach that enables law enforcement to work with our allies overseas to fight crime jointly by sharing evidence quickly and efficiently through clear rules. It enables unilateral law enforcement actions outside the U.S. when a suspect is an American citizen or a resident, reflecting the propriety of building new legal principles based on a person's nationality. So that's something that's before Congress. We'll tell you a little bit more about that on the back end, but I wanted to go ahead and just tee up this issue for you and invite Gene to come in and talk more about the case and what we expect with the case.
Great. Thanks, Mike. As Mike said, while we wait for Congress to take action in modernizing the law itself, we're dealing currently with a case that is currently being litigated on what the extent of the old law actually allows U.S. government law enforcement to do, and what our case arises out of is in 2013, the U.S. government served us with a search warrant for a variety of data that we were storing on behalf of a target of their investigation and asked us to produce it. And when we looked at that search warrant, it turned out that while some of the information resided on servers here in the United States and we could produce it, it turned out a great deal of the content of the emails that target had stored on our servers actually resided on a server in Dublin, Ireland. And so we made a motion to quash is the legal term, to invalidate that portion of the search warrant that the government had served upon us for the data that was stored on the server in Dublin, Ireland, basically asserting that just like physical communications or letters or documents that might be stored outside the United States, the way that the U.S. government should obtain documents that are stored electronically outside the United States is to work with and through the government of the country in which the data is stored. So we liken this to the equivalent of, say you have a safe deposit box at Deutsche Bank in New York City and have stored documents in a safety deposit box there in New York City. No one would think that the German government would have the right to go to Deutsche Bank, compel Deutsche Bank employees to get on the phone, call other Deutsche Bank employees in New York City to open your safe deposit box, take out the contents, make copies of them, and mail them back to Germany. But in fact, that the German government would have to work with the United States government in order to go get access to materials that are stored in the United States. And so similarly, we took the same position with respect to electronic documents stored overseas that they would need to work with the government of Ireland in order to obtain these documents. The district court in New York, this was pending in federal court in New York. The district court there in New York, the lower level court, denied our motion. We appealed that to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is also in New York. And that case was argued in September. It is, we are awaiting a decision, which we expect at any time, actually. It could come down any time. The arguments were made in September, and you know, a typical schedule for an appeals court maybe to get their decision out might be 6 months or so. So we expect that decision to come down at any time and for it to make big news. But as we await that decision, we want people to be informed about what the case is about, what's going on. And we expect after that decision comes down from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that no matter which way it goes, if we don't prevail at the Court of Appeals level, we would expect to ask the Supreme Court to hear the case. And likewise, we think if the government does not prevail at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that they will ask the Supreme Court to hear the case. So either way, we expect the parties to seek Supreme Court review of this issue, and you know, and the Supreme Court's going to need encouragement from people that understand the issues, understand the impact on their businesses, and understand the impact on commerce in general to help make the case to the Supreme Court to take this case. The fact is, under the U.S. legal system, the Supreme Court is not obligated to hear any case. They pick and choose which cases they want to hear. And if they don't take the case, then whatever the Second Circuit Court of Appeals says, that's what goes for the time being, at least for the district courts within the Second Circuit's jurisdiction. So it's gonna take an effort of encouragement to get the Supreme Court to hear this case and kind of bring clarity to what right now is a very difficult legal box for technology providers to find themselves in, where they could be compelled by the United States government to turn over information that sits in another country, perhaps in violation of that other country's laws itself. It more importantly, I think, for everyone on the phone, for us in particular, is the threat that this case and the government's position means towards people's trust in cloud computing and in that model of business in general. Because what you've got is a situation, you know, while very few people probably care about this particular individual and whether or not their information actually gets into the hands of the U.S. government investigators, the problem is the issue won't stop there. If the government's position prevails, of course, it means that any U.S. provider of technology services, you know, could be compelled to produce information, perhaps in violation of the laws of other countries in which they're doing business. And even more importantly, it means that foreign governments will take the lead, so to speak, from the example that the U.S. government has given them, and in turn, seek to apply their warrant capabilities, extraterritoriality too, so that, you know, for example, the Brazilian government could go easily seek documents residing in the United States from any technology provider that happens to be located in Brazil, but also have operations in the United States and the ability to access it. So Sorry, we just got a question on, would this ruling also require companies to surrender private encryption keys? This particular case is not about that particular issue. So that's kind of another separate issue that will, you know, no doubt be litigated down the road or clarified under the law in the coming months. But no, the issue of encryption keys or mandatory encryption or outlawing encryption, that sort of thing, That's not what is at issue here, nor will it be decided. But to go on, like I said, this does threaten to kind of throw the doors open to governments around the world to kind of get documents wherever they reside in the world, which we think and fear will lead to a backlash and a change of behaviors by people that are currently adopting cloud computing as their means of computing and storage on the web. As governments, businesses, and individuals begin to understand the kind of lack of protection and lack of privacy that our government's position and that other governments' positions may cause a backlash against the current model and start to force things like a balkanized web, where things are clearly stored in one country or another, and that access is not even enabled from other countries, which, you know, kind of upsets the upsets all the efficiencies and tremendous benefits that cloud computing has brought to the world, brought to businesses around the world, brought to governments around the world, and would kind of threaten to undermine all of that and challenge it as a business model going forward. So what we've got is a situation where in the next week to 2 months to 6 months, we don't really know for sure, but a decision will come down from the Second Circuit. At that point, we expect one party or the other to seek Supreme Court review, and at that point, we'll be seeking interested parties to make their concerns known and encourage the court to hear the case and resolve the issue. That's a process that will play out over the 6 months following the decision from the Second Circuit, perhaps a little longer than that, but that's kind of the time frame we're looking at to get interested parties involved. There's a number of reasons why this case matters, and it matters to different constituencies for different reasons. But you know, but whether you're talking to someone with different interests or you're evaluating what your own interests might be, you know, we've gone over a little bit of why economically this case and the government's position in this case could have a big impact on cloud computing in general and the businesses that are adopting it to run their businesses. The idea that it could trigger a return to businesses and governments to an on-premise solution because they don't want things to be able to be accessed from other countries. It could force a balkanization of cloud computing and have either country-specific or jurisdiction-specific clouds that aren't accessible from outside that jurisdiction. But a variety of things, all of which would undermine the immense economies of scale and efficiencies that cloud computing is bringing, and the reason it's being adopted so widely, could be blown up as privacy concerns and cross-border concerns start to come into play and customers and governments begin to react to that reality. Other reasons it matters is from a compliance perspective to technology providers, your businesses, our business. You're going to increasingly find yourself in an impossible box, perhaps, unable to simultaneously comply with warrants or court orders in the United States and the law in other countries in which you might be doing business, which means hiring a lot of lawyers and having to work it out, so not greatly impacting the cost of doing business and the certainty of being able to comply with the laws wherever you might be doing business. From a privacy perspective, of course, it matters to your customers. A lot of your customers will have privacy concerns, and the idea that foreign governments could compel someone in their country to access your data stored in the United States and be able to do that legally without notifying your customers, that's obviously a big concern, not for everybody, but for some of your customers, that will be an important thing that they have to understand might take place. It muddies relations between the United States and other countries, as you can imagine, if the FBI were to go, actually land on the ground on an airplane and go into a foreign country and raid someone's offices in that foreign country, the diplomatic snafu would be immense. And this is essentially in a world where all communications basically now are electronic. That's essentially what's going on here, is a raid in a foreign country by a foreign government. So we think overall, this case is important in the short run to get clarity on the law, to bring kind of a common understanding between countries about what the rules are and should be with respect to this kind of accessing documents internationally. And then in the longer time frame, as Mike described to you, we think it's critical that Congress actually address. This is just one issue among many. As you read the paper daily now, new issues are emerging with respect to law enforcement access to data. And while this will address one particular issue, there's obviously dozens and dozens of other issues that need to be addressed, need to be clarified, and need to be done, and that needs to be done by Congress in an organized way rather than kind of on an ad hoc basis through courts, which is kind of what we're doing now with respect to our case. So with that, you know, that's what to expect. There's a lot of information about this case at a website called Digital Constitution.
I'll send it around after the call. I'm going to send some links.
That provides a lot of background material, a lot of the briefings. There were many parties that weighed in on our side of the case in that, and a lot of the materials are there and descriptions of the case. But what to expect is news in the coming weeks or months of a decision coming out of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and then I'd say a campaign, an effort to try to get the Supreme Court to take up this case and clarify it for the country as a whole. So, and that's where things stand. And, you know, we're happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Gene. Mike, did you want to say something else? I saw you come off mute.
Yeah. I was just going to a couple more sort of color commentary that I thought was interesting in the oral arguments in the Second Circuit, which is obviously there are a few areas where the Department of Justice arguing the government's case agreed with Microsoft, and that is under questioning by the judges, they admitted that, yes, the point Gene made, which is, yes, foreign nationals, foreign governments would expect the same kind of rights should the DOJ's arguments prevail here in the U.S. In the future, foreign governments would expect the same kind of rights, and they would demand access to data stored on U.S. servers. From any citizen, including U.S. citizens. So that actually did come up. Another thing that I thought was interesting in the arguments is that the government is essentially arguing that a digital record is a business record, and that in this case Microsoft can have access to it because it should hand over to the government because a business record has less protections than a personal record. And that's why the comparison to physical property, physical notes, paper in your desk drawer isn't the same. And that's the argument that the DOJ is making. You can imagine the chilling effect that would have around the world if the U.S. government succeeded in their argument that just because it's digital means it's a business record and thereby it's the property of Microsoft and Microsoft's able to hand it over versus the property of that citizen. When you think about all the data that's stored on the cloud, personal photographs, contracts, business plans, the case the government is making in this case is that those are all business records and they're owned by the provider in which they're stored. And then finally, there was agreement by all parties, and the justices from the bench, one of the few last things they said was, it's clear that this is something that Congress needs to step in and do their job and legislate to update these laws, because even no matter how they rule in this Microsoft case, the question still will remain, because it's for other cases with slightly different specifics and facts, because the law is still 30 years old and the law never anticipated technology being what it is today. So that's why the LEADS Act is such an important – I'll let people ask questions, but that's why the LEADS Act right now before Congress is such an important issue, and we really want to try to drive as much attention around the LEADS Act and get members of Congress to sign on as co-sponsors. So with that, I will turn it over to people for questions, either to Gene or myself, and then we can wrap it up with Jonathan on to-dos.
Yep, and if you could – thank you, Mike. And if you could just – if you're going to ask a question on the phone, just – say your name and please ask your question. Again, if you're on Skype for Business, you can I am a question in as well. So we are open for questions. If there are any.
Hey, Jonathan. This is Lacey Jamont.
Hey, Lacey.
Hey, I am on the phone, so I couldn't IM this, but mine's more of a comment. And I wondered if anybody else saw the news today about Apple and in regards to the FBI?
Yes.
We definitely saw it, Lacey. My comment is this. I was a little taken aback on the cable news coverage of that, because the sound bites made it sound like Apple was doing something wrong. And that really bothers me because it's very much, in my opinion, what we're trying to do, which is make people aware of how it affects all of us and the privacy and trust issues. It is frustrating to me that we are not getting the kind of coverage and understanding from the public that we should. And how do we address that?
Yeah, that's a fair point, and it's one it's one we've tried to reassure people. Our goal is not to get in the way of, protecting terrorists from being caught by law enforcement or that sort of thing. And
Exactly.
there's plenty of examples where working cooperatively between countries, works just fine, and that the data can be turned over very, very quickly under international cooperation rules and treaties that are in place or that, and can be, negotiated, renegotiated. The Charlie Hebdo situation is one where we were able to get data to the French authorities in very short order, but working under a different system. We don't really have that much information about the Apple situation yet, and I don't think we haven't really sat down to analyze it or even know what we think about it. But it does. Your comment calls into account that we need to emphasize that this is not about cutting off access to information, to information that law enforcement needs in order to do its job. It's about clarifying the rules, setting expectations, and actually putting together what we think is actually a better, quicker system for law enforcement to get what it needs, rather than the current situation we're in with the Department of Justice, which is litigating over, litigating their access to the data because there's no clarity, there's conflicting promises that have been made to customers, and there's conflicting laws that we have to deal with and sort out with lots of lawyers and lots of courts and lots of time. So it's not a trade-off between privacy and security. It's maximizing for both, I
Yeah,
think.
yeah.
And just to add to that, it's a great question. And the facts, as Gene said, are different in the two cases. And they're really they may seem like they're part of the same, but they're definitely on different tracks. The case our case I'll just give you an example. Our case and the subsequent LEADS Act that we think will help solve the issues around in the gray area around our case are really designed to improve and enhance the mutual legal assistance treaties, are called MLATs, mutual legal assistance treaties. And they're agreements between the U.S. government and foreign governments and law enforcement in those cases. And it's a way to help increase cooperation and make the data flow more readily, but do it in a way that's legal and helps preserve this issue where you might have a company that finds itself between conflicting laws. Think of it as a legal bridge, much like the soon-to-be Safe Harbor 2 agreements are for data privacy sharing back and forth between the two countries. So the LEADS Act would help smooth some of that out. And I will say that one example that our general counsel, our former general counsel, now president, Brad Smith, has given before is around the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, that was a national security event, obviously. The French authorities felt like there was some information possibly in a Hotmail account by one of the possible attackers. They called the DOJ. The DOJ called Microsoft. Within 45 minutes, there was a protocol. This protocol existed. Within 45 minutes, Microsoft was able to search the files and provide the data back in the case of this national security emergency back to French authorities so they could pursue. That's an example where in a national emergency, there are established protocols. The French authorities know who to call the DOJ. DOJ knows who to call at Microsoft or other technology providers, and it moves very smoothly. In the case of criminal cases between the two countries, far less. Those well-oiled protocols don't exist. They're very spotty. You have gray areas, which creates for legal challenges, which slows the process down. And as anybody knows from watching the Paris attacks in December, everybody that was involved in those Paris attacks all started out with criminal records, and they were criminals. But we don't have the same kind of well-oiled protocols between our most trusted partners in law enforcement to deal with these kind of criminal elements, like we do in a national security emergency with the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And what the LEADS Act will do is help modernize those agreements, so that way there's the French lawyers know exactly who to reach out to, or in this case, the Irish authorities and the U.S. authorities, to go get the information they need in a way that protects and honors the laws of the local host countries. I hope that answers your question. Oh, and then Doug, I think you asked, I see Doug Levin asked, can you say a little more about the LEADS Act? What are the key provisions? How will it help law enforcement in addition to improving privacy? That's what I just discussed, is the MLATs. It's really modernizing the MLAT agreements, creating protocols that are well established and legal, that parties on both sides of the Atlantic can use to get access to data. At the same time, it does protect people's privacies because it would respect the case of a U.S. citizen abroad or a non U.S. citizen abroad with data that's housed abroad would not be subject to a bench warrant from a U.S. judge without proper notice and going through the proper channels.
Thank you, Mike. And I just added, for those who are on Skype for Business, a couple of links. So one's to the Digital Constitution. The other is to our Voices for Innovation LEADS Action Center, which has some additional background information about the LEADS Act. For those who are on the phone, I will definitely send that out when after the call. A couple more questions. So I'll just ask in turn, is there any specific information that applies to HIPAA?
Nothing specific with respect to HIPAA in either of these proposals. So they would have to interact with HIPAA as it exists today. So yeah, I don't think there's any special modification or change in the way that HIPAA would have to be dealt with.
One interesting thing to think about, though, is like the DOJ argued in the Court of Appeals, is that if foreign governments wanted access to the data of U.S. citizens on U.S. servers, well, what would a firm do? Would they give that information to a court in Europe if it violated the HIPAA laws here in the U.S. if it was employee data, and it was a multinational company, they had European employees and U.S. employees? How would that be handled? That's the reverse of what we're being asked to do in Ireland.
And that kind of highlights that conflict of laws and compliance problem that will manifest itself in a variety of ways, where you can't simultaneously obey a court order and the law of whatever country you might be in.
Great. We have another question. How are other companies responding to this? And I'm just assuming, and Devel, if you wanted to clarify, assuming are other companies supporting LEADS or the case, or was there something else you were asking?
Yes, just whether other companies like Apple, IBM, other technology companies are supporting this, and what's their position on it?
Sure.
A number of other companies weighed in with amicus briefs in the Second Circuit on our side and support our position generally on the case. I'll let Michael talk about the lobbying activity going on with respect to LEADS, but at Digital Constitution, which is the link they just sent, we've got a lot of the materials that other technology companies or coalitions of technology companies have weighed in on the case.
Yeah, and so Verizon, AT&T, Apple, Cisco, to name a few.
IBM, many of them. It's actually it's interesting to look at those who signed the amici briefs, because it's a who's who of brand name companies and media outlets tech luminaries who all sort of weighed in and said this is a tremendous problem. If the government's arguments prevail, it's a tremendous problem for cloud computing and sort of the growth of high tech without obstruction. But it's interesting to see, like, you have Fox News on a brief with NPR. You have all kinds of sort of strange bedfellows. And the same is true in the tech space. A lot of really hardcore competitors signed on to the briefs. And then on the lobbying front, or on the LEADS Act, we do a lot of work with IBM in this case. Apple has been involved in this in helping us go to the Hill on this issue. We have discussions with Google, Facebook, and Yahoo. They all recognize the problem. They might like to see some minor tweaks to the bill. But they all agree that the laws are outdated and this is harming their business. And the events that we see in the news constantly about, you know, this notion that the government has easy access to the data of foreign nationals is a problem for them selling their products overseas. And so they all want to see Congress step up and do what the justices on the Court of Appeals suggested, which is update the laws, modernize the laws, have them reflect a modern reality of a global networked cloud computing world.
Right, and I would just add to that too. A number of people on this call were in D.C. in October, going to the Hill as well, talking about the impact on small businesses. So while we've been talking about a lot of large tech companies, you know, as Gene talked about, as Mike talked about, as you're well aware, you know, small companies too are impacted by this. Your customers are impacted. The way, you know, you guys may be using or selling cloud services, that's all at stake here. And so it's equally important for small businesses to talk about this and raise their voices up in support of leads and the case. Any other questions or comments that people want to share? Oh, we have one coming in on IM. So the last question is, how do we get started to get our voices out on this case? And thank you for asking that. So I think that there's a few ways to get involved. The first, as we've been talking about, just to reiterate, is that we think it's important that Congress act. I think fundamentally that's something that needs to happen. And so I shared a link, and I'm going to share this out with those who are on the phone. But at our Voices for Innovation website, www.voicesforinnovation.org, we have a Leads Action Center where we have it set up for you to be able to send a letter to your elected officials. And, you know, I can attest to the importance of elected officials hearing from technology and business leaders like yourselves. It matters. So we're asking people to write their elected officials. For those you know, that use Twitter, we also have a way that you can tweet your elected officials. Believe it or not, a number of elected officials monitor their own Twitter accounts. And so that's actually a very nice way to have some direct communication with them. Another way that you can get involved in getting your voices out is that you can write a letter to the editor in your local paper. I can share a link with you about how to get that done, again, through our Voices for Innovation tools. We make it very easy for you to do that. And then finally, and this is something Gene and I were discussing when this question came in, is that, you know, once a decision comes down from the Second Circuit, we are going to be working with the VFI community to see if there are any companies that would be interested in participating in an amicus brief. And once we get to that point, we can certainly talk about what's involved with that. But if there are companies that are interested in participating in that, signing their names onto something like that in support of the position that we laid out here, we will certainly reach out to you and let you know that. So you can let me know that if you're interested now. And again, you know, as this progresses, we're certainly going to be reaching back out to those in the VFI community to talk to them and ask them to support Microsoft's position in this case. So that's my wrap. I encourage you to get involved with VFI. Mike, I'll give you the last word.
If you don't mind, sorry. I just want to one more thing on the law enforcement question. I should have mentioned this as well. There are law people who have a law enforcement, laws, you know, national security perspectives who have weighed in on this case. I mean, Secretary Chertoff was the Homeland Security Secretary under George W. Bush. Has weighed in. I mean, he's recognized that the laws need to be updated in this space. He feels like the where that we are, We are actually doing a disservice to the law enforcement community by having laws that are so outdated. And the fact is, we have to live in a global world, and global data is moving around. You want to have really well understood and established protocols with foreign law enforcement to help get access to some of this data. But you want to do it in a way that's very cooperative and not in a way that's sort of standoffish. And he's not alone. There are a number of national security minded folks who have weighed in the space. And I should also say that this is a case around narcotics. It was a case that I think is a bit of a test case. I know that privately back channel, there are many lawyers at the DOJ who feel like, you know, they're uncomfortable with the laws that exist today because they feel like it is this gray area, and they don't, you know, lawyers don't operate very smoothly in an area of gray when it comes to enforcing the law. And so they want to have courts rule, frankly, to try to help establish law because the law is so outdated. But the courts, as we know from the oral arguments, have said Congress needs to step up. I will end by saying that we do expect there to be a hearing at some point in the near future that will address some of these issues in the House of Representatives, and that would be in the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives, which is chaired by Representative Goodlatte of Virginia. So if any of you have a presence in a state, or you have a member of Congress in the House or the Senate who's from the Judiciary Committee, I would really, you know, suggest and hope that you would write a letter using the Voices for Innovation tool to them today. And I think there are three points to make if you're so inclined, and that is that the laws covering lawful access to electronic evidence are 30 years old and they need to be updated immediately. Americans don't believe that something they write on their computer is any less private than something that they write in a letter, and that needs to be addressed, and that Congress should modernize the legal framework by pursuing agreements with other governments that help work together to fight crimes jointly by sharing evidence quickly and efficiently through clear and established rules. And those are really the three big points that we want to try to promote in letters to the Hill to try to get Congress to address some of these issues. So I will leave it with that. And
hey, Mike, I forgot one other thing. So on sending an email in our tools, we do have some draft language in there for you to make it easy. But you can certainly edit that. And as Mike was saying, you can make some of those points. When I send out a follow-up to this conference call, I'll include some of those points in there as well, which you could take and edit in our tool online. So.
And yes, you can copy that. Someone asked a Quadoval. Ask the question, can we copy the content on the LEADS website?
Yep.
Sure, absolutely. And put in your LinkedIn feeds and others, absolutely. Or the Digital Constitution site. Would love to have you help us get the message out.
Yeah, social media is a great way. Email as well, if you know others who may be willing to write in on this issue. You know, please email them and point them to VFI. We really appreciate the support, and it's important that we get the word out. So with that, we'll conclude. Thank you very much. Thank you for everyone for taking time out of your busy days to join us. And we look forward to working with you on this issue as well as many of the other issues that impact the IT sector. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, everyone.